24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn. Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Lenny Aquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, and Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist at the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning and welcome to Community Matters. I'm your host, Laura Sumner Kuhn, and I'm delighted today to have two fabulous guests with us from the State Public Defender's Office. Today we have Trial Division Director Jennifer Bias, who happens to be a Mount Pleasant resident. Welcome, Jennifer. And we have John Padgham, who is the Deputy State Director of the Public Defender's Office. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. I appreciate your taking time to be with us today, and this will be a wonderful opportunity to explain what the Public Defender's Office does and some of the challenges it faces in our state. I thought maybe I should start by just reading the mission as posted on your website for our listeners who may not be aware of your overall mission, which is to zealously represent clients, protect constitutional rights, and advocate for an effective and fair criminal justice system. You also have a commitment to treat clients with dignity and compassion, and that is kind of your mission for us in the state of Wisconsin, which has been rather challenging for the last, I don't know how many years, right? Maybe we could start by just talking a little bit about who you are and what you do for the Public Defender's Office, and then we'll kind of get into some of the other issues that you've faced in those positions. So whomever would like to jump in, go right ahead.
Well, you said it all when you read our mission statement, Laura. We really have a wonderful, I think, state constitution that gives us the mandate that you read. And we have a number of staff, over 600, you know, lawyers, investigators, social workers, clerical folks who help us carry out that mission statewide. All 72 counties are served by staff from our agency, the courts, the jails, and importantly, our clients and their families. That's how we meet that mission every day.
When I talk to school groups, I always start with the scene from any good cop show, which is the officer reading the rights to it. And, you know, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be. And then they get to the part about if you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. And everyone knows that. Everyone's seen it on TV. And that's who we are. When you're in trouble and you can't afford a lawyer, Gideon, the Constitution say, everyone who sits down in that chair in front of a judge gets a lawyer, and that's us.
Right. Could you tell us basically what the parameters are to qualify to be appointed a public defender if you're charged with a crime?
Well, it's really an individualized assessment financially. We have a form basically that we go through. We ask questions about income. We balance that against other assets and debts. And we let people know almost instantaneously based on our form whether they qualify for us or not. The level to qualify, it's pretty low. Most people who qualify for our services, you know, are unemployed or the working poor.
Mm-hmm. Below the federal poverty level for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Which hasn't changed in a long time.
Correct.
So it is very low based on family size and income and assets, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Goodness. And you have sort of two ways in which you fulfill your mission. One way is with all of the direct employees that, Jennifer, you've talked about. But then there's also a need that the department has to go to outside private attorneys to seek adequate counsel for people who qualify and are waiting for that. Can you explain how that works and what determines when you need to get a private lawyer to defend somebody?
So, you know, basically, Laura, we have a large number of cases that come in, and the staff of the public defender strives to provide representation on all of those challenging cases, the serious charges, the challenging legal issues, and then there are cases that we just cannot handle. So an example might be if there is an allegation of a crime. Two people, three people, four people commit that offense allegedly together. Our office, our staff can only represent one individual out of that group. And the other three individuals who are charged would need to be represented by the private bar. That's based on, you know, ethical rules as well as our internal administrative codes and processes and rules. And so we look to our private bar partners to, you know, help us out and to take those cases and provide excellent representation. And it's not just any private bar lawyer who can step up and, you know, take the case. Our agency also trains private bar. We certify them. That's what the process is called, to make sure that they, you know, understand the area of law that they're going to provide representation in, that they're able to do a good job. And there are ongoing training requirements, continuing legal education requirements that they must meet. They often come to, you know, conferences that the public defender provides to meet those requirements.
We have an absolutely great staff in mm-hmm. offices throughout the state of Wisconsin, 375 lawyers and support staff, but we simply can't do it all. And if you and I are both arrested for something tonight, we both get our own lawyers, and that's what the law and the Constitution say. And so we rely heavily on our private bar attorneys to take those conflict cases, and they do a great job for us, and we appreciate all their efforts. And fortunately, the state of Wisconsin, the legislature, and the governor just upped the private bar rate for the first time in decades from $40 an hour, which was the lowest in the state, to $70 starting January 1st with cases. So we're hoping that that'll inspire more private attorneys to come onto our roll and take our cases. And we know they believe in the mission and believe in the work, and now they'll be able to afford to take our cases.
Do you know how many, roughly, how many certified private lawyers you have kind of on your list of people to call, or is it difficult to keep those slots filled and as well as your own staff of public defenders filled? Is there a lack of, you know, lawyers?
Oh, excuse me. It ebbs and flows, and it's driven by the county. I mean, we take people who work and live in the counties to take the cases, and we rely on those. But some counties have a bigger pool than others. Or up north right now, or in smaller counties, there simply aren't lawyers. I mean, there's a crisis along those lines, too. And to get some of those people to take our cases is even more problematic. But if we have, say, a big opioid bust in a smaller county where there's 3, 4, 17 recently co-defendants on one bust, we're begging people to come from all corners of the state to take our cases.
So until January, those lawyers who travel, say, all the way to Ashland or a place in the upper reaches of Wisconsin, get $40 an hour for their ability to represent one of those clients, that hasn't been very attractive to them, right? So you probably, we've talked about stories that have come out about the backlog of people who have been charged with a crime who are waiting for a trial. Do you have any idea what that looks like? How many defendants are waiting for counsel? Because either, you know, we haven't been able to attract the private attorneys that need to represent them, or they're just simply not existent in those areas?
I think virtually every county in our state has a story to tell along those lines. You know, you might think about Milwaukee and Madison, Racine, Kenosha, lots of lawyers in those counties, right? But even those counties now tell stories about how they're not able to find lawyers because of the low rate. And as John has said, in northern Wisconsin, there just aren't lawyers who, you know, are able to take our cases and are certified to take our cases or interested in doing so. So we suffer from really two problems in the state that are kind of coming together and creating this issue for every single, you know, town, community, village in Wisconsin. And yeah, I'm hopeful that the $70 an hour rate will improve things immensely. I worry that the $70 an hour rate will still possibly not attract new grads right out of law school into places like Ashland or Peshtigo, Marinette County and Forest County and some of those other places across the state that are struggling to attract those new professionals.
We have an absolutely great support staff network and the people in the individual offices who make the assignments or try to recruit the attorneys to take the cases, and they work tirelessly. A lot of them take it personally when somebody's in jail waiting, and so they call, they send emails, they get creative as they can to get people to try to come to see people.
If I'm not mistaken, the $40 an hour that you're still operating under is the lowest in the country.
Yes.
And moving it to $70 an hour might help somewhat. Can you talk about why that had been such a battle to have the state legislature that when it passes the budget, I would assume, that kind of sets that standard. What has gone into that delay? Is it pure politics, or from your perspective, what has happened that we've become the lowest paying state for public defenders, and that, you know, jeopardizes somebody's right to a speedy trial and their constitutional rights?
I think that it's been a constant and recurrent request from our office for our budget to up the rate for as long as I can remember. And the budget is a difficult thing, and politics are certainly involved, and there's different needs. And we have done a remarkable job, I believe, of making do with a little, and we have just a tremendous private bar who believes in our mission and believes in the fact that nobody sits at that seat alone, and so they've stepped up to take it, but it really just reached this tipping point where they simply cannot afford to take the cases anymore. They're losing money on some of these cases, and so we're grateful that the legislature has done it. We look forward to January 1st. We hope it comes very, very quickly.
I would imagine so. I would imagine so. Can we talk a little bit about the clients you serve and the constitutional rights that they have for representation? And perhaps I might be wrong in this, but I get a sense that in our American society now, we don't fully appreciate the importance of that constitutional right, or that it is for everyone, no matter what. Do you feel societal thinking challenges to our constitutional rights to representation? Do you feel that battle is out there somehow?
You know, I do think that there is a bit of a battle around the constitutional right to be presumed innocent. I think that some of the suggested changes for bail reform take a step back and take a look at that issue. After all, bail is about ensuring that an individual shows up for court and isn't meant to, you know, be used to keep an individual in custody while they're facing whatever allegations have been made. I think, you know, that the fact that we live in a media-saturated community and world and universe right now, stories come out, they're really portrayed, individuals are really portrayed as if they are guilty when they are arrested. And we don't hear about situations where charges are reduced or dismissed, or there's a trial and an individual is found not guilty at all or not guilty of lesser charges. So I think there is kind of a way that we approach and look at criminal justice issues currently that causes us to kind of rush to judgment, or maybe there's no judgment at all. We just automatically assume when someone is arrested, they must be guilty, and our system takes care of that for us.
I think that one of the saddest manifestations of the opioid crisis and the methamphetamine crisis is the fact that it's moved into all neighborhoods, and people can no longer say it's those people or how do you represent those people, because the fact of the matter is we're representing our neighbors, our friends' children, aunts, uncles, brothers, and I love my job. I love going into the jail, that first meeting with somebody where it's the raw emotions and just getting to know somebody's story. How did we get here? The social factors, if it's a bigger city or small town, they're all at play. But we represent individuals, you know. We represent somebody's dad, somebody's son, daughter, aunt, uncle, niece, nephew. And our job is to get to know those people, know the law, and make sure that a system that has this reputation for being very tubular, very machine-like, gets to know those people too, and make this person, this individual, come alive for the prosecutor who also is overworked and has 30 cases to look at this morning. I need her to look at my person as an individual, and that's a great gift, and it's a great honor to have that trust placed in us.
I feel so much better hearing you say all of these things that we would hope would be at the heart of any kind of justice system. And I think it's interesting that in your mission itself, it talks about looking to help create a just and fair criminal justice system. So I would imagine that part of your roles or your jobs are involve helping to educate the public to understand what social issues are out there, where there may be inequities in the system and the people that end up being tied up with the system. So we're talking about the people that you represent are the poorest in our communities, right? That's why they would need you in the first place. So they're already at a disadvantage economically that might have all kinds of reasons wrapped up into how they ended up in the situation they're in to begin with. And then there are racial inequities in the system that I think are finally getting more and more review and understanding on a wide societal plane than have been before. Could you speak a little bit about any of those realities that we face that then become part of what you deal with?
Well, absolutely, Laura. I mean, you know, the criminal justice system, especially in Wisconsin, is known for being number one in racial disparities amongst juveniles, amongst adults who are going through the system. Every key decision-making point in Wisconsin, from arrest to charging to sentencing to correctional alternatives to, you know, reentry to our communities, are all impacted. And we see a racial disparity. And what that really means is that when you look at the population of our state, you look at the population of any particular county, the racial and ethnic minorities that make up that community are extremely low in number. But when you look at the jail or the courthouse, I always say if you go to the jail in any community, the overwhelming number of individuals in that jailhouse are African American, Native American, or Hispanic. And so if if that's what we see kind of visually as the story of the Wisconsin justice system, we really have to, you know, take a look and figure out how to do something about that and reverse that, because it really kind of bespeaks unfairness. John mentioned, you know, the drug crisis. There's also a mental health issue in our state. Many of our clients, many of the individuals who, you know, occupy our prisons and our jails across the state are mentally ill. And unfortunately, jails and prisons have become, right, our mental health institutions. When you couple, you know, age, race, addiction, mental health issues, that's the population that makes up our criminal justice system. As a community, as a taxpayer, we really need to take a look at that and find out what's the best way to reverse that trend, to address those issues without using our really, really expensive resource, the criminal justice system. And quite frankly, we've known this for years and years as well. The criminal justice system is not only the most expensive alternative or way to address those issues, but it's the least effective. And so we've got to come up with evidence-based, you know, ways to address each of those issues and turn that that impact that we're seeing around.
There's a couple of little factoids that shock me every time I see them, and one of them is that the zip code in the north side of Milwaukee is the most incarcerated zip code in the country, in our state, in our backyard here. And it just doesn't seem right. We have so much in Wisconsin. We have so much to offer at so many levels that to have that dubious distinction just isn't something that we should tolerate. And there's another statistic, that floors me every time I hear that, and that is that Wisconsin employs more prison guards than the state of Wisconsin has prisoners in their prison system. Wisconsin employs more people as prison guards than Minnesota has in their prisons. And if you go back to the individual level and we consider the fact that that's somebody's dad, that's somebody's mom, 95% of the people in that prison are going to get out sooner or later, and we need to reintegrate them into the system. We need to reintegrate them with families. We need to get them jobs. We need to set them up for success. And it's a very daunting task. And so really, as Jennifer said, if we're the intake for mental health issues, that's just wrong. And we really need to look at some of the diversion programs that are on the rise and partner with all the stakeholders in the court system, human services, to keep people out of jail, to keep people out of prison, and to offer the services when we know the cracks are there.
I want to take a minute to remind our listening audience that you're listening to Community Matters, and today my guests are Jennifer Bias, who is the Trial Division Director for the State Public Defender's Office, and John Padgham, who is the Deputy State Director of the Public Defender's Office for Wisconsin. And you bring up some very troubling facts and realities about the justice system in Wisconsin. What kinds of reforms do you think are needed and could be made in some way for people to get behind now and really understand? What are there some steps that we can take to repairing the damages that we know are out there in the system?
I think we should take a look at our juvenile justice system. I think there are a number of kids that we end up charging and bringing into the juvenile justice system that should never be there in the first place. We should take a look at our educational system and whether our educational system is really a school-to-prison pipeline and funnels kids into that juvenile justice system.
Could you explain that a little bit?
So policing in schools, turning every, you know, incident that a child's brain produces, every behavior that a child engages in, into a crime for which they're then charged, punished severely in a juvenile justice system. Sometimes in Wisconsin, in our adult criminal justice system, ultimately leads to those individuals being stuck in that system, remaining in that system. Because once you're in the juvenile justice system, the criminal justice system, it's very, very likely you are going to remain.
Can I just jump in there for a second?
Absolutely.
Because one of the issues, and it's a very helpful, concrete example, I think, is that a 17-year-old is charged as an adult in Wisconsin. There's a movement to move that up to 18, which would be huge. But a 17-year-old kid who picks up a marijuana possession charge, different jurisdictions across the state handle them very differently. Illinois will soon make it legal. But a 17-year-old kid in Wisconsin who picks up a marijuana conviction no longer has access to student loans, no longer has the same access to housing when he or she grows up. And all of these collateral dominoes that just can crush hope at 17 years old for a marijuana conviction. And so just addressing the juvenile system and how we deal with first-time offenders and the age is just a huge step in the right direction.
I have a couple questions related to that. Can you give us a sense of what proportion of clients that you handle at the public defender's office are juveniles? And then are they mostly drug convictions? What kind of rises to the top among the charges that juveniles in this state face?
Yeah, I don't have specific numbers, you know, to kind of throw out at you, Laura, but I will tell you that in every one of our offices, we have at least one or the equivalent of one staff person who handles juvenile matters across the state. And you know, John makes a great point. You know, if you're 17 and under, technically you're, you know, in juvenile court. I mean, the main thing I would say about that is there are so many decisions that we don't allow 17-year-olds to make as an adult. But you're okay to, you know, go into the juvenile justice system and suffer punishment there for, you know, these kind of juvenile behaviors. And when I'm thinking about those kinds of behaviors, I'm thinking about brain development issues. We know mm-hmm. the science indicates that, you know, children's brains are not formed fully or even close to that until they're well into their 20s. And yet our criminal justice system, our juvenile justice system does not reflect, you know, that truth, that reality.
So there are, imagine taking your example, John, of a 17-year-old who decides to pick up a marijuana joint and smoke it and gets caught with it and charged with it. There are all along the way places where discretion could be used, I think, that the law, even as it exists now, might give law enforcement officials' discretion about whether or not to make an arrest, and all the way down the line, who could you walk us through kind of an example like that, and where there could be some different thinking even among the people now in those roles, where life could be different for those juveniles who have made a mistake.
Yeah, several jurisdictions have ordinance or municipal ticket violations that do not bring young people, or even adults for that matter, into criminal court or juvenile court for low-level misdemeanor possession. The amount, you know, that you mentioned, a joint, a single joint, or a small amount of pot would not land someone, you know, in a situation where they're facing incarceration or substantial fines. I know that Racine and Milwaukee and several other counties in the southeastern Wisconsin area have put those kinds of referendum on the ballot, and they have been successful. And so the move is really to allow law enforcement to have a lot more judgment about whether or not to move forward with those types of criminal charges, provide a ticket if it's the first offense, or provide a ticket if it's a certain amount very consistently and across the board. That's a move, I think, that has, that's the way that Dane County, for example, has approached that issue, specifically drugs, for a number of years. We also, you know, in this part of the state, seem to charge individuals with felonies. Second offense of a controlled substance becomes a felony, and we consistently look for and tend to charge individuals who are African American, mostly males, with second offense possession of marijuana. And again, that sets them up for the collateral consequences that John described with regard to, you know, going on to school or just having housing if they remain in this community.
Is that, just to be clear, is that a local decision or is that a state law decision? You know, I mean, what determines how much discretion somebody would have?
Yeah, to be clear, the district attorney is the one who decides whether charges will go forward after reviewing, you know, typically a police report or a sheriff's department report from an arrest that's been made.
So the DA's office has quite a bit of discretion it can use
Yes.
in those cases.
Absolutely. And we partner with them and we work on them through programs with first offender programs, with diversion courts, drug courts, mental health courts, vets courts. There's a litany of specialized courts and diversion programs, specialized services to try to assist people in avoiding convictions or getting on the right path to avoiding more serious convictions if it's a younger person.
Let's talk about those different options, if you will, because from what little I can remember from that, and I know, Jennifer, you've done a lot with the Racine County Drug Court in trying to urge the use of that facility for defendants. Tell us a little bit about the growth or the stagnation of use of those courts and what is required of the defendant to be able to enter into them or how that decision is made to use that diversion to somewhere else that gives them a little more hope and support and treatment.
Well, John can jump in on a lot of the technical issues, but my understanding is that both Racine County and Kenosha County have treatment courts and a veterans court that's available, and that individuals are referred and evaluated and assessed for their appropriateness and whether they meet the requirements to receive the treatment that the court will provide in the method that the court has available to it. We sit on the treatment court. We participate with the other stakeholders, individuals from corrections. There's a judge who leads it. There's a prosecutor who participates. There are treatment providers who also participate, as well as law enforcement. And all of them are expected to come together and, you know, kind of discuss and evaluate and enforce the rules that have previously been agreed upon about who is appropriate for the treatment court. It's important that treatment courts pull in individuals who most need the treatment, right? So those people look like, you know, maybe they've committed some serious offense. They have a really bad drug problem. Their addiction may be longstanding. And it may have, it may be evidenced in a lot of different ways. They may have a lot of disruption in their family. They may not be employed, and so on and so forth. Those are the individuals that we want to attract to our drug treatment court, because if the treatment court is going to provide the safety that the community needs, those are the people that we want to get into the court. We want to give them the tools to be able to be successful, right, in overcoming that addiction. And maybe they've never received tools before. Maybe they've never tried to stop before. But something about the current criminal justice interaction and contact has inspired them, you know, to go into the court and to give it a shot. And so I think the resources, the very, very, you know, the large amount of resources that a drug treatment court is able to expend can really help to make our community safer as individuals take part in that, learn how to, you know, address their addiction and to be successful in remaining clean and sober. It's a really important part of every community, I think, and a number of communities across the state of Wisconsin are starting to really embrace the idea of implementing a treatment court in some aspect of their county. Our state legislature has started to fund those efforts. We are working on a national level in this state with the Community Justice Coordinating Committee that was organized as a statewide group to kind of encourage those local efforts and to bring the group together of stakeholders that I described earlier. You know, you really take a look at every single community in this state, and there's a drug problem. There's a serious drug problem, and there are individuals that, if we could really address their addiction and their problem, our communities would be a lot safer.
These groups are tremendously collaborative efforts. They involve the judiciary, the prosecutors, the defense, probation and parole, treatment providers within the community, good Samaritans in the community who step up. They devote hours a week in offering services to people, offering support to people, offering rides to people, drug tests on a random and regular basis to hold people accountable, assistance with getting work, treatment issues, and it's very rewarding to see the system work together to try to address the needs.
Do you think some of the problem is, I would assume from listening to you, that these courts are not used to their capacity, or perhaps they are used to their capacity, but there's limits budgetarily about how many people can be funneled into those alternatives. Can you speak to either one of those instances? Are they used to capacity? Do people know enough about them? Do the defenders and the prosecutors know enough about them and really urge people to use them? That's one issue. And the other is, you know, are we set up financially to be able to handle the load that actually could be there?
Yeah, I really feel like we are underutilizing. I mean, I think we've, you know, increased our capacity across the state, but we're nowhere near the capacity that we need to have. And if you use the prison population as a measure to determine what we need with regard to treatment of addiction, so that we're not using prison beds, but we're allowing people to remain in the community and addressing their addiction that way, we have a major amount of need in this state. And other states have expanded their capacity. I mean, I look at a state like Oklahoma, very small budget, but every single county, every single jurisdiction there has found a way to include, you know, private businesses as stakeholders. Walmart and other businesses, you know, provide the incentives, the rewards for individuals participating in treatment programs in that state to you know, keep them engaged and to, you know, continue to address that whole, you know, cycle of addiction and the need to have a reward. I think that it's important for everyone to be engaged and to also kind of understand how the treatment court is implemented in the community as well, and that would certainly increase the participation as well. So,
anecdotally, I certainly can't think of any treatment courts around the state that I'm aware of that aren't at or near capacity, most with waiting lists.
Really? So it becomes more of a budgetary limitation or resource limitation to expand how many people they can handle in that alternative setting?
It's tremendous work for everyone involved, and so the amount of resources that go into any of these treatment courts is phenomenal, and that's true of us. It's true of the prosecutors. It's one of the issues that parity is so important for us, is to be treated the same as everybody else. And if we're going to expand, you know, in smaller counties especially, with the judge runs it, and there's only one judge, and he or she is spending a lot of time on these courts.
Right. I can only imagine the challenge and the predicament that your office is in. I mean, 72 counties, 72 communities that all have, you know, unique approaches to how they handle this and trying to engage all of those different people and perspectives around the table, as you had described, John, it has got to be time-consuming and difficult in some communities just simply for the lack of people who might be there or their caseloads or their, as you said, their time limits. What kinds of things can the average Wisconsinite be aware of that might help resolve some of these criminal justice issues that we've kind of just very briefly touched on this morning? What can the average person do to make themselves more aware and more of an advocate for change in our system?
You know, my gut initial reaction was simply read the full article. When you read the paper, we're all very good at clickbait or just reading the headline and moving on. But as you look at these things, consider how this person got there, what the needs are in the community, and try to read it as though you're reading about a loved one, because we need to move beyond that simple clickbait, so-and-so, this, and the press is presuming people guilty, and we all know that's not right.
Yeah, I would also agree with that. You know, at kind of a basic level, what can every individual do? Vote, participate when you get a jury summons. Don't run the other way. If you have an opportunity to go watch court, go watch court. Those are my reactions.
Oh, that's all great advice. And how many times have we heard somebody who's moaning about the fact that they have they've been summoned for jury duty, and think about ways to get out of it when this is our opportunity to make sure justice is here for all of us.
That's
so
right.
Even just that perspective alone, and I would imagine, too, you're just kind of running counter to popular media portrayal of what happens in the court systems, right, and what happens out there in the world and who your defendants are or are, you know, who's needing defense without thinking about them as a family member or a loved one. All great advice. Well, it sounds like there could be continual discussion about things that we hope would change, but we should all be thankful for all of your time in the system, holding up the constitutional right for a fair and speedy trial and for reform to justice where it's truly needed. So my thanks to you, Jennifer Bias and John Padgham, who came here today to spend time describing this function for us in our state that we should just be thankful that it exists and that we support it and you're here. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show, you will hear the inspiring story of Dominique Pritchett, who managed to overcome a difficult childhood of poverty and homelessness to graduate from Carthage and is soon to be certified as a psychologist. She speaks at the Civil War Museum on Tuesday evening as part of their Courageous Conversation series. Support comes from Carthage College, combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. More information at carthage.edu. Support comes from Carthage College. For the first place Milwaukee Bucks, on-court success goes hand-in-hand with a winning business strategy. At Carthage College, Tuesday evening, February 18th, team president Peter Fagan will describe how the Bucks have ignited global markets while impacting digital gaming and community development. Admission is free, but you're asked to RSVP at carthage.edu/sports. That's Tuesday, February 18th at 7 p.m. in the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business.
Jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more is available 24 hours a day on your desktop, laptop, smartphone, or radio. To access 24/7 Jazz WGTD on your computer, go to WGTD.org. where you can listen live, online, 24 hours a day. On your smartphone, download the free WGTD app. In the Kenosha Racine area, 24/7 Jazz WGTD HD2 is available via HD radio. For more information, call 262-564-3030.